gates of hell, but I won't back down. I'm gonna stand my ground, won't be turned around, and I'll keep this world from dragging me down. I'm gonna stand my ground, and I won't.
You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
The beginning of wisdom is found in doubting. By doubting, we come to the question, and by seeking, we may come to the truth. This quote is from Pierre Abelard, of Abelard and Eloise fame, French philosopher and teacher and theologian, born 1079 and died 1172, so that's a long time ago. Welcome to this place of peace, hope, and love. Our community stands on the side of love. We've got the banner out the front. Here at Unitarian House, we don't tell you what to believe, but we do ask you to consider what is said today on your own personal and responsible search for meaning. Unitarians don't have a creed, but we use our seven principles as our moral compass and guide. We recognise that our Norwood Church, like the one that preceded it at Wakefield Street, were built on Kaurna land. Next week the service won't be here, but instead will be held at Shady Grove at 11:30, and this is our smaller pioneer church near Littlehampton in the Adelaide Hills. It's on Peramank land. We honour their elders, and I'll name one Peramank man whose spiritual support at Shady Grove is much appreciated, and that's Ivan Copley. He participated in Beau's funeral. We recognise the connection with country of Indigenous people and honour this connection from the past and into the future. Indigenous elders will always have a voice in our rituals and in our hearts. Unitarianism has been present in South Australia since 1854. After the service, feel free to linger for a chat as long as you do your very best to maintain social distancing. We're not yet serving coffee, but we're probably ready to review our routines for next year after the AGM in November. And now we're going to go do the story for all ages. Charlie's not here, so I'm going to tell the story. And it's called Proof. All the young Unitarians could come to the front if they like, and there's even chairs for you at the front if you like chairs rather than sitting down. Now, I've got a picture of a guy, that's about 600 years ago, and in the late 1500s, he was most people's idea of the very best scientist in the whole world. And everyone believed Aristotle's claim that heavy objects fell faster than light ones. That is, everybody except Galileo. Don't sing out. Put your hand up. Now, to test Aristotle's claim, Galileo dropped two balls of differing weights from the Leaning Tower of Pisa. And guess what? They both hit the ground at the same time. Aristotle was wrong, but so what he did about that was he fired Galileo from his job, because you're not allowed to say the boss is wrong. That actually is a cultural habit that persists to this day. But for his place in history, he showed us that testing is the best way to discover what's true. Now, if we fast forward to modern times, challenging commonly held assumptions about computers and human behaviour, Steve Jobs lost his job with Apple in 1985. Of course, he got it back again and made a lot of money. Returning 12 years later, he changed the way people use technology by testing the truth of other people's claims. As a result, history considers Jobs one of the most innovative minds of the 21st century. So Galileo and Jobs were skeptics. They developed habits of thinking that challenged what seemed to be reliable facts, and they understood that testing assumptions over believing famous people led to greater understanding and creativity. Now, it's easy to confuse being a skeptic with being a cynic. So let's define our terms. What cynics do is that they distrust what they hear, particularly when it contradicts what they like to believe. Most often, cynics hold views and any evidence doesn't change them. They're often very rude about other people's ideas. People who are driven by inflexible beliefs don't think like Galileo or Jobs. Galileo or Jobs were just interested in finding out what was right. They didn't have a big investment in being right themselves, necessarily. People constantly make claims that affect our daily lives. Advertisers do. They'll always tell you something's delicious, and how do you find out? You try it. My parents, I was about 11 when TV hit Adelaide, or we hit Adelaide, because we lived in the country, didn't have TV, and there was a product called Rice Arisso. And they made it sound absolutely fantastic. And my mother decided she would cure us of believing advertising, so she bought it and made it up. It was horrible. It had the weirdest metallic, chemically wacko taste in the world. Anyway, there's a book called Don't Believe Everything You Think, and it shows how easily we can still be fooled and why we should learn to think like a scientist. So I believe you're going to be doing some science in Sunday Club today, so that's really good. But I've just got a little question for you. Can you think of anything that you believe that you know that your friends don't believe? And the other thing is, can you think of a way of testing your own belief? I think it's easier to test what other people believe, but that's a bit of a challenge. So
Because if you test something you believe, then you have to actually think of the thing you believe first.
Well, you do, yeah. All a bit tricky. Well, see you after the service, kids. The prayer of someone. This is what happens when you think too much. Our something, who may be somewhere, hallowed be thy nebulousness. Thy vagueness come, thy doubt be known on earth, as it might be in heaven. Give us this day our daily hypothesis, and forgive us our certainties, as we forgive those who force their certainties upon us. Lead us not into presumption, and deliver us from thinking we know the answers. For thine is the question, the seeking and the waiting, at least for the time being. During the shutdown of this church, apart from doing the carpet and walls, we did a book check and threw out oxidised paperbacks of classic titles that are easily attainable today. But some books were specific publications for Unitarians and have a certain curiosity value. This book, Living the Questions, was circulated in England and the USA, and a copy ended up here in Norwood. Helverson, the author, grew up in a family of six children in Missouri. His dad was a farmer. He served only two ministries in his entire career, 16 years at the First Unitarian Society at Ithaca, New York, 18 years at the First Parish in Cambridge. He had chaplaincies at Cornell University, at Harvard, and Radcliffe. He ran a student exchange program with the Royal Cambridge in England. He was awarded a Doctor of Divinity by a theological college affiliated with the University of Chicago. With a resume like that, you might be expecting something academic, conservative, and a bit pompous. A working life in top institutions and no obvious setbacks. But no, he is an absolute master of plain English, although written for a 1970s readership,
Some of what he had to say, I think, is particularly applicable to this age, where Googling passes for research and polar opposites abound. And I'm going to ask Iran to read on needing the opposition we reject.
We should always consider thoughts we have which contradict our emotions. And not to be forgotten are those ideas that we say we disbelieve, and how important they are to sustain the things we do believe. Whatever in the world would most people do without ideas that they reject? They become persons only in terms of what they are against. How often it is with many people that their stern denunciation of things, their unbelief in things, is founded upon blind belief in other things. A fanatical devotion to what is called virtue often makes genuine goodness impossible. Furthermore, the comprehension of the moral community calls for higher achievement than the denunciation of others' errors and corruptions. To satisfy our need to denounce is not enough to gain the goals we have set our hearts on. Life is styled for many people by the evil that they oppose. Life is shaped for them by what they do not wish to be. While this appears to be a fact of life, what is darker in you is the other fact that many people's virtues feed on the vices around them. They need the evil to define their good. The man who fights what he calls the rotten condition of things needs that rottenness to give his cause luster. The righteous man who thunders from some Mount Olympus about immorality adds to his zest. The smut fighter who slithers around newsstands gloats over that smut and feeds his illness on it. It has often been revealed that anti-pornographic crusaders have an inordinate love of pornography. What would the Democrats and Republicans do without each other to dump all the evils on? Each side looks for some crack in the solid armor of opposing political machines, and when they find it, they gloat over it. They seem to need the opposition's evils to define their cause. There is hardly a righteous cause in the world that does not feed on the evil that inspired it. While no one becomes a saint through other sins, many of us never seem to realize this. One must judge men not by their opposition to evil, but by how much they seem to need it, and even at times to love it. What would the fundamentalists do without hell? Eventually we must come to a maturity that does not separate the world into black and white, good and bad, one part against another part. We must try to find that which is common to both. This may mean we must stop talking about morality and start to talk about specific evils and goods. Is there a good word for Judas? Is there a case for smut? Is the righteous person out to purify the world so different from the rest of us? It is community we need, not enemies. And as members of the community, we may realize that in our good there is much evil. And there I go using terms that are not specific. So long as we try to be members not of the community but of our own specific aspects of it, we may cut away and declaim the parties, the state, whatever, and never stop long enough to see what it is we're feeding on. There's much with this world that needs to be improved. The problem is how to state it, how to do it. The world is often unwise and unjust, but too often it makes up for this lack of humanity by being damnably self-righteous.
A leader, especially a politician, who expresses doubt is seen as indecisive rather than capable of nuanced thought and self-reflection. By contrast, certainty is considered a strength. The leader who acts from unwavering confidence appears forceful and trustworthy. Lee Sales wrote that in 2009. In 2008, John McCain, the Republican nominee for the presidency of the United States, asked Sarah Palin to be his running mate. I didn't hesitate. I answered him yes, because I have the confidence in that readiness and knowing you can't blink, that you have to be wired in a way to be being so committed to the mission we're on, reform of this country and victory in the war. You can't blink. So I didn't blink then, even when he asked me to run as his running mate. This confidence did not come from experience. She had been mayor of a town in Alaska, Wasilla, for 6 years, and the governor of Alaska for 21 months. No federal government experience, no foreign policy credentials. Her country was ensnared in two complicated wars and was in the throes of the global financial crisis, and she didn't blink about becoming the vice president.
She gave rambling, incoherent interviews and was protected only by the culture wars of the time. Like, isn't she inexperienced? Oh, so's Obama. She lacks readiness? Oh, stop being sexist. She's out of her depth in interviews? That's just the bias of East Coast liberal media elite and their gotcha journalism. On the other side of the Atlantic, right-wing journalist Melanie Phillips wrote in the Daily Mail, not only is she attractive, witty and feisty, her love for her Down syndrome baby embodies hope for the future. As for her pregnant 17-year-old daughter's proposed shotgun wedding, the priority there is the welfare of the unborn child. By contrast, the right to choose feminist left, which also thinks all women have the right to deprive a baby of its father, appears not just callous and selfish, but even downright murderous, which is why so-called progressives on both sides of the Atlantic have gone into paroxysms of rage and panic over Sarah Palin. Well, Palin, mother of five, was pro-life, which in the US has no connection with supporting mothers and babies. It means anti-abortion. She's creationist, anti-climate change. Her oldest son was in the wars for domestic violence. She worked very hard making same-sex marriage constitutionally impossible. Well, fortunately, McCain and Palin lost. Palin resigned the governorship of Alaska in 2009. After that, she took part in the Tea Party movement, was accused of inciting the shooting of an Arizona congresswoman in 2011. She worked very hard to get Trump elected in 2016, but let's try for a bit of balance here, shall we? She has changed her mind on the subject of human influence on climate change. And after 31 years of marriage, she's getting a divorce, so one might afford her a soupçon of sympathy on that score. Regretfully, the songbook Sarah Palin used has not been thrown out, and the current President of the United States is famous for never doubting his own abilities, knowledge, or judgment. But before we can feel a bit smug about not having elevated Mark Latham or Barnaby Joyce to our prime ministership, how do we as a nation feel about doubt? How do we treat politicians or journalists who express doubt? Let's look at an Australian politician who isn't generally put on a pedestal, and I'm not here to elevate him or to tear him down. Wayne Swan. Asked in 2009, which was at the end of the global financial crisis, if he'd ever experienced self-doubt, he said, I think all people in life go through that, and the most important thing is to be honest about it. If you're experiencing self-doubt, it means that you're aware of vulnerabilities, and sometimes I think it might be a bit better than people who just assume confidence in everything they do full steam ahead. Well, that just about knocked Lee Sale's socks off when she read it. Unlike Tracy Grimshaw, she's constantly assailed by self-doubt. She wrote a little book on doubt in 2009 and a revised version in 2017. And in it, she traces her lifelong habit of doubting authority to a very mundane source indeed, one that we're all subject to for years and years. Parental authority. Not necessarily to the degree she was. Although I'm considerably older than Lee Sales, my parents were firm but not really authoritarian. Family cultures vary. It's not all about the times are changing. It may also be about place. She was raised in the Pine Rivers Shire on the outskirts of Brisbane. Kevin Rudd is alleged to have said that when you cross Pine Rivers, you hear the sound of banjos, which is a reference to the creepy rednecks in the 1972 movie Deliverance. Rudd, of course, denies ever having said that, and I will leave you to come to your own conclusions on that one. Anyway, this is a taste of her childhood. On the first day of primary school each year, my mother would say, with a pointed stare in my direction, if she's any trouble, give her a thrashing, and then send her home with a note so that I know to give her another one. If we visited somebody's home with mum and dad, we were to sit quietly until invited to do otherwise. No matter how much my fingers itched to touch their piano, no matter how much I was dying to make their cocky talk,
No matter that I remembered from a previous visit that there was a calendar in the toilet showing cartoons of famous people with enormous private parts, I would not dare move until given permission. Now, do you remember that calendar? It was Pickering. Pickering, yeah. I've been trying to remember that for a week and it just popped into my head now. Cool. Discipline was strict in our house. There was no more powerful tool than Mum's threat. I'll tell your father when he gets home. Dad was an infantryman and a regimental sergeant major by the time I was a teenager. Dad was accustomed to giving orders to soldiers all day and being silently obeyed. Seemingly from the cradle, I had an uncontrollable urge to respond to all his directives with, "But why?" At the end of a dressing down, he would roar, "Do you understand?" I would, somewhat unwisely, often pick him up on a point or two, seeking clarification. Lee found it hardest to hold her tongue when her parents' logic was flawed. Her mother would decree that it takes two to fight, so she and her brother deserved equal punishment. "It doesn't take two," she would cry when hauled to her bedroom. "It takes one. It takes him coming in here and slapping me when I'm just reading my book." She would resist by wrapping a foot around a table leg and winding an arm through a chair as her mum stuffed her into the room. And she'd rant, "Why are you saying it takes two? You can't explain it because it doesn't make sense." The back chat and constant questions did not stem from rebellion alone. She was curious about everything. A chronic eavesdropper, she'd strain to hear TV programs like Prisoner through the wall, even though they scared her witless. And at school, she'd burst with satisfaction at discovering a teacher's first name. "It's not Mrs. Cantarucci," she'd tell her best friend breathlessly. "It's Vicky." During the school's weekly religious class, she and her brother were sent to the library as their mother did not want them brainwashed. This bred in Lee an intense curiosity about religion. In year 12, a good friend invited her to his church youth group. This started an association with Christianity that lasted till her early 20s. The church had an engaging social scene, slick music. It offered serious Bible study, but it failed her test. How do I know this to be true? She needed reason, evidence, logic. She could not accept, "You just need to let it go and have faith," or, "Because it's in the Bible." That was profoundly unsatisfactory and the equivalent of her parents' mantra, "Because I say so." Predictably, atheism struck her as being just as unattractive as Christianity, because it too required a leap of faith into a position of certainty, albeit in the opposite direction. The only thing in which she found faith was doubt. It was instinctive and it spread well beyond her attitude to religion and into politics. If someone subscribed doggedly to a particular political ideology, it struck her that they were constrained by it. She felt people with an unwavering certainty in themselves, in their beliefs and opinions, suffered from a form of moral vanity and she didn't want to be like that. She feared she'd never genuinely learn anything if she started from the mindset of certainty. She liked learning more than anything else. Is it any wonder she chose journalism as a career? But what about her assumption a doubtful mind would be a professional asset? Andrew Bolt, Philip Adams, Piers Ackerman, Mike Carlton, Alan Jones, Greg Sheridan, Janet Albrechtson. Do you read any of these journalists for objective analysis? Or do you know they hold strong political views and read them just to be either affirmed or outraged? Or maybe just entertained? Many of these can be witty or engaging, and hidden within their generally unapologetically one-side diatribes are nuggets of insight occasionally. But frankly, and now I'll show my hand, I think it's disgraceful that most of Australia's highest profile commentators are people who act as if they've never experienced a second of self-doubt or entertained the thought they might have been wrong. Point scoring instead of educating audiences, playing to their own cliques, neglecting the wider public, selectively highlighting facts that support their own positions while conveniently ignoring those who don't, skewing and distorting the views of opponents, taking them out of context, magnifying tiny errors. All these are tricks of the trade I loathe. That's when I recognise them. I can't claim to consistently see through all the distortions of logic, but I do generally recognise commentary that toes an ideological line without swerving. Who was it that said, "A political ideology is a very handy thing to have"? It's a real time saver, because it tells you what you think about things you know nothing about. I do hanker after the journalism of the Frankfurter Allgemeine, which I used to read when studying German 2A. The main article would supply Hintergrund, that's background. Then there'd be the story, and then the commentary, all differentiated. Well, that's long gone. But there is another thing that's lacking in modern commentary, and that is civility. Let me share with you a letter written in the 1960s by one of the era's highest profile writers. This is from Norman Mailer, a radical left-wing writer, to William Buckley, who was the famous conservative founder of the National Review. January 1966. Dear Bill, I send you the enclosed not because I love the National Review so much, for I don't. It's not as good as it ought to be. It's often tiresome, especially when one knows in advance what your trusted old load of contributors are going to say. But as a personal mark of respect to you, your letter was the best letter I ever read by an editor asking for funds. One request. Please keep my contribution in the secret crypts. It's not so much that I fear public opinion as much as ceaseless repetition. Repetition kills the soul, and I would not want to spend 100 evenings in succession explaining to various outraged and somewhat stupid people in calm, clear fashion my complex motives for giving a gift to a magazine to which I feel no affection and to an editor with whom on 90 of 100 points I must rush to disagree. They would not understanding that good writing is good writing and occasionally carries the day. Yours, Norman. Well, Bill was honourable, and the letter wasn't published until after the deaths of both writer and recipient. It was published in the New Yorker. Contrast that with the unseemly clashes between Robert Mann and Gerard Henderson, Australian liberal academic versus conservative Australian commentator. More than 10,000 words of insult and vitriol via email were shifted from private inboxes to the public domain, online or in print, with no pause to consider whether publishing this stuff was in the public interest. And you know the oddest thing of all? They both actually agreed that Wilfred Burchett was a communist and on the wrong side in the Cold War. The results of certainty untempered by doubt are often ludicrous in the world of journalism, but in the world of politics, they become sinister. Consider this. Look at the leadership of France, the UK, and the USA. Emmanuel Macron, Boris Johnson, and Donald Trump. I began this address having a fair crack at Sarah Palin for being unqualified for the position to which she aspired because of deficits in experience as well as education. She wasn't successful in her bid for leadership, but these three were successful despite their lack of political experience. In Australia, votes for minor parties have soared in recent election, and we've even had politicians who start their own parties. Nick Xenophon and Cory Bernardi, effective for a short time. Why? Well, our current era, I think, is characterised not by doubt, but by cynicism. People despise politicians who come up through the ranks of their parties and are therefore vulnerable to those who claim to be untainted by the party machine. Because they're new brooms, they'll tell it like it is. Politicians like Kim Beazley or John Hewson did it tough in their era because the electorate found them less than exciting, not colourful enough, not certain enough. People did not appreciate deliberate or moderate remarks. They preferred the outspoken. You know where you stand with politicians like this, Pauline Hanson, Derren Hinch. The obvious question is, but do you like where you stand with either of these? And do you really know where you stand with people who define themselves by what they oppose? And I hark back to Iran's reading. They become persons only in terms of what they are against. We crave certainty as much as we crave sugar, and it's just as dopey. When Hendrik Herzberg was asked what he thought the most common misconception about Jimmy Carter was, he said that Carter whinged and whined about others. This was no doubt triggered by the infamous Malaise speech in which Carter referred to paralysis, stagnation, drift, growing disrespect for governments, churches and schools. Reagan, of course, countered that easily. He did his relentless sunny optimist impression and said the night before the election, "I find no national malaise. I find nothing wrong with the American people." Herzberg contradicted this view of Carter, saying, if anything, Carter made the opposite error to blaming others. He engaged in an excoriating degree of self-criticism that he inevitably disappointed others when he was unable to remake his own image. Sadly, I think we're in the poo because of some of our long-held cultural assumptions. For example, the idea that idealism is juvenile. When a character in a play or movie is asked to go beyond their job and help with a cause, the character sometimes refuses and the other person says, "What's happened to you? Since when did you stop caring?" And the answer comes down to the character saying, "I grew up," implying that the character grew from a wide-eyed idealist to an embittered cynic. Many shows and media that are on the idealistic end of the sliding scale of idealism versus cynicism are primarily targeted toward children, while cynical media with more controversial plots are targeted to adults or attract controversy from moral guardians. So idealism isn't framed as an actual, legitimate philosophy that adults can make use of. This conditioned bias is the major reason for why many people believe true art has to be angsty. My contention is that excessive cynicism or pessimism are just as blinding as too much idealism or optimism, particularly when cynicism is used to counter applying infection control, safety measures, mitigation of climate change initiatives, and so on. When it all boils down, in order to solve problems at family level, national level or even global, we need to collaborate. And the nature of the collaborative process for tackling complexity is one of emergence. The central tenet is, I know it. The central tenet is, I don't know. If we attempt collaborative processes to tackle some vexed and complex issue, assuming that doubt equals weakness, we sabotage the whole thing. In the end, facts matter. Integrity matters. Honesty matters. Our own opinions are not always right. It's vital to be open to the views of others. If we all embrace honesty, integrity, open-mindedness, will reason, truth, and logic ultimately triumph over fake news, post-truth, terrible leaders? Simple answer is, I don't know. But I'm not afraid to say so. What I am afraid of is to join the other parties like pure idealism, pure cynicism, pure pragmatism, because you end up being morally compromised beyond belief. So here's to mixing our own Unitarian cocktail and doing our best to tease out facts before evolving opinions and launching actions. Be vulnerable. Listen and explore. Maintain a sceptical attitude when you meet those who have no question, when you meet those who know the right answers, when you meet those who tell you what to do next. For truly they are the Wallies of the world. Stick with the weird and the wonderful.
Line up with the Jimmy Carters, the Ruth Bader Ginsburgs, the Tim Fishers, the Greta Thunbergs, because to be led by a coward is to be controlled by what a coward fears. To be led by a fool is to be led by the opportunists who control the fool. To be led by a thief is to offer up your most precious treasures to be stolen. To be led by a liar is to ask to be told lies. To be led by a tyrant
is to sell yourself and those you love into slavery. When vision fails, direction is lost. When direction is lost, purpose may be forgotten. When purpose is forgotten, emotion rules alone. When emotion rules alone, destruction, destruction. There is no end to what a living world will demand of you. These are the words of Octavia Butler. Do you believe? Belief will not save you. Only actions, guided and shaped by belief and knowledge, will save you. Belief initiates and guides action, or it does nothing. And finally, kindness eases change.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitarianessay@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching Essay Unitarians.